Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Colson Whitehead is with us in studio today, a best-selling author and Pulitzer Prize finalist. Whitehead's new novel, The Underground Railroad, tells the story of Cora, an enslaved woman trapped on a cotton plantation in Georgia. Whitehead is unflinching as he recreates the brutality of slave life in the antebellum South, and Cora decides to make a treacherous bid for freedom, as her mother did years earlier. She learns of the Underground Railroad, which, in Whitehead's telling, is not a secret web of safe houses and routes, but an actual rail line leading eventually to the North and possible freedom. Without giving away any more of the story, Colson Whitehead, welcome to Radio Times.
Hey, howdy. Thanks for having me back.
Sure. So the enslaved woman, Cora, in the Underground Railroad is your protagonist. Tell us more about her. Who is she?
Sure. She's 16 or 17. She doesn't actually know. Slave masters didn't keep track of their property's ages. In the same way, you might have a dog named Fido and know that he is 7 years old. You might not know he was born on August 31st. And so she could be 16, 17. And her mother's run away a couple years before. So in the language of the plantation, she's a stray with no family, no one to take care of her. She's been fending for herself for many years. And then one day, Caesar, a new arrival to the plantation, brings up the idea of the Underground Railroad. He has suffered an unfortunate calamity. He was raised on a small farm in Virginia and had been told his whole life that he would be sold once his master died. His master didn't leave a will, and so he and his parents were sold with the furniture and the buggy and all of his owner's stuff down south. And, you know, with each state, you go more and more south, the worse slavery gets. So he is quite surprised when he comes to the plantation where Cora is.
So we're going to get to a passage in just a moment from your book. But first, you know, back to Cora for a moment. In reading her story in this book, if I had known she was 16 or 17, I think she'd be much older than that, maybe in her 30s or 40s, even 50s, just because of I guess how life has treated her. She doesn't seem like a child.
The ordeal of slavery puts a lot of mileage on you.
Yeah.
She was partially inspired by Harriet Jacobs, who wrote a famous slave narrative. Harriet Jacobs says that, you know, when a slave girl hits 14, she enters the most horrible time for a girl on a plantation. When she hit puberty, you're supposed to breed, pump out more babies who can then pick more cotton and make more money and, you know, keep the machine of slavery going and the cotton industry going. And you're prey to your master's desires, the desires of other slaves, and the fact that you are mere property in this different, terrible dimension becomes more apparent. So she's 16 or 17 and maybe, you know, a bit older by the time we meet her.
Yeah, lost the light pretty early. Yeah. All right, so let's get to that passage. In this passage, Caesar and Cora are on the run, and they're brought to a railroad station by a white man named Lumley, who leads them into a barn. And it's the passage on page 66, the bottom paragraph.
Sure. And, you know, someone asked me on Twitter if Lumley was named after this famous abolitionist. And I was like, no, I it was random. I just picked, I named him after Carl Lumley, the actor. I've seen him in many things. So a lot of my names are sort of random in this book. But
all right.
Carl Lumley represent. Lumley lit a lantern and gave it to Caesar while he kicked some hay and pulled up a trap door in the floor. At their trepidation, Lumley said, I'll go first if you wish. The stairwell was lined with stones, and a sour smell emanated from below. It did not open into a cellar, but continued down. Cora appreciated the labor that had gone into its construction. The steps were steep, but the stones aligned in even planes and provided an easy descent. Then they reached the tunnel, and appreciation became too mealy a word to contain what lay before her. The stairs led onto a small platform. The black mouths of the gigantic tunnel opened at either end. It must have been 20 feet tall, walls lined with dark and light-colored stones in an alternating pattern. The sheer industry that made such a project possible. Cora and Caesar noticed the rails. Two steel rails ran the visible length of the tunnel, pinned into the dirt by wooden cross ties. The steel ran south and north, presumably, springing from some inconceivable source and shooting toward a miraculous terminus. Someone had been thoughtful enough to arrange a small bench on the platform. Cora felt dizzy and sat down. Caesar could scarcely speak. "How far does the tunnel extend?" Lumley shrugged. "Far enough for you." "It must have taken years," Caesar said. "More than you know. Solving the problem of ventilation, that took a bit of time." "Who built it?" Caesar asked. "Who builds anything in this country?" Lumley answered. Lumley relished their astonishment. This was not his first performance. Caesar said, "But how? With their hands, how else? We need to discuss your departure." Lumley pulled a yellow paper from his pocket and squinted. "You have two choices. We have a train leaving in 1 hour and another in 6 hours. Not the most convenient schedule. Would that our passengers could time their arrivals more appropriately, but we operate under certain constraints." "The next one," Cora said, standing. There was no question.
Yeah. This is not the Underground Railroad of the history books here in America. So, first of all, why did you decide for this book to reimagine the structure of the Underground Railroad?
Yeah, I came up with the idea 16 years ago. And at that time, I usually started a book with a strange what-if premise. And so my first book, The Intuitionist, started from, what if an elevator inspector had to solve a criminal case? John Henry Day's about the folklore hero was, how do we, you know, what if we updated this industrial age anxiety myth of John Henry for the information age? And so, whereas my last couple of books have been more character-oriented, back then I liked the problem of the what if. And so I was sitting on my couch, came across a reference to the railroad, and remembered how in fourth grade when I first heard about it, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this, heard the words Underground Railroad, and they're so evocative, and envisioned a network under America. It's not very practical, and I'm sure my teacher told me how it actually worked. It was more of a social network. But that day I thought, oh, what if it actually was a literal tunnel? What kind of story could you get out of that? And so that was the premise. And then fleshing it out, I added another complicating element, which is that every state our protagonist goes through, South Carolina, North Carolina, is a different state of American possibility, an alternative America, what might have been or what could be, sort of like Gulliver's Travels, as Gulliver goes from island to island, interacting with different parts of British history and culture. So would our protagonist find a different America each time she emerged from the tunnel.
Yeah. So, and as far as the Underground Railroad is concerned, it's a thread that runs through the story, but we never really find out who built it and how. You didn't get into too much detail with that.
No, I mean,
you wanted it to perhaps be a structure to the story?
It's not, I could have spent 10 pages on describing the tunnel. It's not what the story is about. It's about these different islands of American experience that, that Cora finds on her journey north.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's little relief from the nightmare of slavery for Cora. The first stop for her is South Carolina on the Underground Railroad. And the white man who meets them, Sam, says to her, "You're a long way from Georgia. South Carolina has a much more enlightened attitude toward colored advancement than the rest of the South." And we soon find out this isn't so. So the seemingly inviting medical center that Cora visits.
Sure. I mean, I think, I don't write historical novels. I'm not going to get kicked out of the historical novel writing union. And so once you make a literal tunnel, you pretty much departed from reality. And so that allowed me to have a larger conversation with American history and place different events in friction with each other to see what came up. And I guess after I had this very realistic first section in Georgia on the plantation, I felt free to play with things. And my rule was, I'm not going to stick to the facts, but I'll stick to the larger truth of things. And so, again, ahistorical, but in my South Carolina, this alternative South Carolina, the government, benevolent, has bought slaves from their masters and freed them and given them housing and jobs and education. And by not sticking to the facts, I can sort of play around with progressive social programs, you know, from the, say, the 1960s, a Great Society, and see how they would have played out with a slave population. And
but there's a dark turn there. You feel finally, and I knew it was early in the book, so I thought, oh, she's made it, but no, wait.
No, there's another 200 pages to go. And so I bring in the Tuskegee syphilis experiment.
That's what I was wondering. I was wondering if there's this medical sterilization program that is happening that Cora eventually discovers, and I thought, wow, I wonder if there's an allegory there.
Sure. Well, yeah, it's very early in the book, so you know, we're not doing too much damage to the story. But yeah, I mean, I felt free to bring in various sterilization movements in America when we would sterilize the feeble-minded, people of color, people who are having too many babies, and for their own good, in the same way that...
So to speak, yeah.
And then the syphilis, the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, African-Americans with syphilis were told they were being cured. They're actually being given placebos and monitored over time to see, check out the, you know, how the decades would ravage their bodies. So there is that sort of darker element to the progressive structure of South Carolina. And again, by not sticking to the facts, I was allowed to talk not just about the treatment of African-Americans in slavery, but in the 1920s and, you know, different periods.
It's a work of fiction.
It's a work of fiction, yes.
Yeah. So who is Ridgway?
Well, you need a good villain. So Ridgway is an embodiment of American imperialism, maybe American exceptionalism. I should probably look that up. But it seems like when we're talking about American exceptionalism, we seem to sort of overlap with some of Ridgway's philosophies. And so...
He's a slave catcher.
He's sent to retrieve Cora and anyone who's run away, and he's the best at what he does. You know, through him we get to explore, you know, certain imperialistic impulses in American history. You know, he says if blacks were not supposed to be in chains, they wouldn't be in chains, and if the red man was not supposed to give up his property, he wouldn't be retreating across the plains and in front of the white advance.
More on that in just a moment. Colson Whitehead is with us. He is the author of The Underground Railroad. And this reminder, he'll be appearing at the Free Library of Philadelphia tonight at 7:30. But he's with us now, so stay with us for more of Radio Times. It continues in just a moment. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and Colson Whitehead is in studio with us. He is the author of The Underground Railroad, and we went into the break talking about the slave catcher Ridgway, and I'm curious, you know, if you could, Colson, describe Ridgway's relationship with Cora, because at one point she's in custody, you know, at one point in his custody. And in their conversation, it's almost as if they're equals. And I was struck by that because she was the prey and he was the predator, and yet she felt free to talk to him at points as if they were equals.
Sure. Well, you know, she starts off as an object with no agency on a plantation, and she takes this heroic step off to run north. And that's the start of her becoming a real person and not just property. And so when she's in South Carolina and has these misadventures with the government, she's expanding her notion of what freedom is, of what she's capable of what the world is. And so hopefully, you know, I'm taking someone who's uneducated and basically grown up in a cave and trying to come up with different interactions and characters who can expand her idea of what the world is, and in a plausible way, have her bump up to with the larger systems of how America operates. And Ridgway's one of them.
Is it a cat and mouse game with Ridgway in that he, as the slave catcher, allows this conversation?
Sure. I mean, on level, it's an adventure story. You know, the stakes are incredibly high, life or death. And, with this fugitive slave law, 1850, you could be living in New York or Massachusetts for a decade, run away from a plantation, and suddenly you weren't safe anymore. Slave catchers could reach across states into free states and bring you back. And so Ridgway is an agent of this sort of monstrous law and monstrous brute fact of slavery. And then Cora is his opposite, this rebellion, this rebellious energy, this life force, this hopeful being who wants to escape everything that Ridgway represents.
And again, she's very young. I have to remind myself as I'm reading this book, 16 or 17 years old. All right, so let's get back to some of Cora's experiences. I believe she's still in South Carolina when she gets a job in something called the Museum of Natural Wonders. And she's introduced to someone called Mr. Field, the curator of living history. If you could pick up on the story for just a little bit.
Sure. I'm trying to find occasions for Cora to learn about the world. And so she gets a job in this museum. And it sounds odd, but, it's a living diorama, and she plays different roles across the day. And it sounds strange, but, at World's Fairs, African-Americans were dressed up as Africans in jungle garb, and pretended they were in villages. Carnivals, circuses displayed African-Americans in costume to, represent the Dark Continent. And so this section is her first day at work in the museum. It's a promotion because she's a bit clever. But of course, she's never seen a museum before. And Mr. Fields gives her a tour. He explained the business of museums. In this one, the focus was on American history. For a young nation, there was so much to educate the public about. The untamed flora and fauna of the North American continent, the minerals and other splendors of the world beneath their feet. Some people never left the counties where they were born, he said. Like a railroad, the museum permitted them to see the rest of the country beyond their small experience, from Florida to Maine to the western frontier, and to see its people. People like you, Mr. Field said. Cora worked in three rooms. That first day, gray drapes covered the large glass windows that separated them from the public. The next morning, the drapes were gone, and the crowds arrived. The first room was called Scenes from Darkest Africa. A hut dominated the exhibit, its walls wooden poles lashed together under a peaked thatch roof. Cora retreated into its shadows when she needed a break from the faces out there. There was a cooking fire, the flames represented by shards of red glass, a small, roughly made bench, and assorted tools, gourds, and shells. Three large black birds hung from the ceiling on a wire. The intended effect was that of a flock circling over the activity of the natives. They reminded Cora instead of the buzzards that chewed the flesh of the plantation dead when they were put on display. The soothing blue walls of the room called Life on the Slave Ship evoked the Atlantic sky. Here Cora stalked a section of the frigate's deck, around the mast, various small barrels and coils of rope. Her African costume was a colorful wrap. Her sailor outfit made her look like a street rascal with a tunic, trousers, and leather boots. The story of the African boy in a ship went that after he came aboard, he helped out on the deck with various small tasks, a kind of apprentice. Cora tucked her hair under the red cap. A statue of a sailor leaned against the gunwale, spyglass pointed. The eyes, mouth, and skin color were painted on its wax head in disturbing hues. The room called Typical Day in a Plantation allowed her to sit at a spinning wheel and rest her feet, the seat as sure as her old block of sugar maple back on Randall Plantation. Chicken stuffed with sawdust pecked at the ground. From time to time, Cora tossed imaginary seed at them. She had numerous suspicions about the accuracy of the African and ship scenes, but was an authority in this room. She shared her critique. Mr. Fields did concede that spinning wheels were not often used outdoors at the foot of a slave's cabin, but countered that while authenticity was their watchword, the dimensions of the room forced certain concessions. Would that he could fit an entire field of cotton in a display and had a budget for a dozen actors to work it. One day, perhaps. Cora's criticism did not extend to Typical Day's wardrobe, which was made of coarse, authentic Negro cloth. She burned with shame twice a day when she stripped and got into her costume.
So Juan Gabriel Vasquez, in reviewing this book for the New York Times, says the Underground Railroad is about the myriad ways in which black history has too often been stolen by white narrators.
And we see Mr. Fields' narration here, and it's a nice story. The Middle Passage, obviously, you know, the brutal movement of Africans kidnapped from their homes, dying on their way across the Atlantic, didn't really have, you know, cheerful black urchins, you know, swabbing up deck. We were chained below in the hold, head to toe.
And this story is being rewritten, obviously, here. So do you agree with what Vasquez is saying? In that this book is about the myriad ways in which black history has too often been stolen by white narrators?
Partially. You know, I think, yeah. This scene. And here, you know, talking about Cora's agency, it allows her to critique. It allows, you know, me as a writer to expose her to fake history and give her agency so she can critique the white curator's image of an African village, critique the Middle Passage, the way it's depicted in the museum, and challenge him in a way that she's never, you know, been able to challenge people before she left the plantation. And so as she gets, you know, further and further north, she is moving into this larger notion of herself.
Mm. You know, I really love the book, but I found it so hard to read at times. You are, you're particularly, you know, you talk about the realities of slavery, and particularly brutal in your depiction of the fate of, Big Anthony, an enslaved man who manages to escape for a short time. Considering that I'm not sure if kids are listening at this hour, but could you just give us a quick synopsis of what happens to him?
He's burned alive in a display of punishment to prevent anyone else from running away. And, you know, whenever I thought
and there
I was...
there were onlookers who were just... It's almost like there's a party atmosphere while this is happening.
Sure. The master is having some guests over and It becomes part of their entertainment. You know, whenever I thought I was... came up with something grisly, I would go back to my research and realize that actually, I wasn't really stretching it that much.
I'm sorry, you weren't stretching it.
No. I was not. No, I mean... if you have 100 slaves and one runs away, you have to keep the other 99 from fleeing also. And so you make an example. You cut off their feet, burn one alive to keep the other 99 in line. And so, I'm just a writer writing a book for a year. I can't really compete with the sadistic punishments thought up by slave masters who watched their father discipline slaves, for decades. And yeah. My imagination is, you know, quite small compared to the quite baroque and horrible imaginations of the slave masters themselves.
Well, so when did you find then when you were writing this that you needed to step away from some of this stuff, the research that you were doing and then extrapolating it into the story?
Well, the hardest part was doing the research and then realizing what I'd have to put Cora through just to be realistic. And while I do alter history... you know, once she gets to South Carolina, I want that first section to be as realistic as possible. If only to honor, you know, my nameless family and ancestors who went through the system. You know, I don't know much of a lot of my family before 1900.
Is it something that you like to know and that you feel you'll actively search out at some point?
I actually had no curiosity afterwards. But, you know, I've said, you know, I know that my mother's grandmother came from a line of free men and free women who owned taverns in Virginia. And I guess I had a cousin who had done the whole family lineage and was like, well, actually, it goes back even further than that, and sort of corrected me so I can stop giving the wrong information in interviews. But, you know, that's one line. And I have, you know, grandparents who came out of Florida and Virginia. And where were they? Did their parents live in Louisiana? They're sort of lost in the – or Georgia or Florida. They're lost in the sort of black hole of slavery. So I want to be realistic, and it is hard. It is difficult material to read, to write, and contemplate. It was also a reality. For me, once I started the book, I sort of had the necessary distance and engagement. You know, you have to be in it with the characters to make them real, but also a part to shape the material in an artistic way. And I found that balance fairly quickly. And my office is in the basement, and so I'm always down there. And then I can always come up to the light and make dinner for my family and hang out with them come 3 p.m. So work was very separate for me.
Well, you have. We were talking outside before the show began, and you have two small children. And so do you want their youngest children? So down the road, if they want to read this book, how is dad, you know, would you walk them through it? Because there's tough stuff in here.
Well, my daughter's very sweet, and she's 11, and was excited about the attention the book was getting. And for the first time, I was like, oh, I'm going to read it. And she got five pages in and didn't mention it again, which is fine.
She's a little young.
So she'll come to it, you know, or not in time. I'm not going to push it on her. I have some more lighthearted books she can start with. You know.
Let's get back to your protagonist, Cora. Her mother, Mabel, had escaped the plantation when Cora was just a young child, as you mentioned earlier. In Cora's mind, leaving her to the inconstant mercy of the world. So the character Cora cannot forgive her mother and even at times seems to hate her. Why did you write her this way with both mother and child are both escaping the same thing?
Well, you know, I was trying to make it psychologically rich and plausible to me, and it seems, you know, perhaps I'm a weak person or a bitter person, but it seemed if I was 8 and abandoned to sadistic slave masters, rapists, and the daily violence of a plantation, and my mother saved herself and not me, mm-hmm. I might harbor a little resentment.
Sure.
And so that seemed to be a plausible way for Cora to frame things.
Yeah. Her mother's on her mind, though, so she thinks about her. There's still that mother-child connection.
No, yeah. I definitely had plenty of dudes in my books with daddy issues. I hadn't actually explored a mother-daughter relationship before. Yeah. So it was interesting, and hopefully it lives and explains a lot of Cora's actions.
Okay, so let's, before we get to the break, one more reading, if you would, and I hope we have time for this. It's about the young African-American boy named Homer, who is Ridgway's companion. And if you could read this passage on page 200, it's an interesting relationship between these two, and I'd like to get into that a bit.
Sure. The driver of the wagon was an odd little imp, 10 years old, Chester's age, but imbued with the melancholy grace of an elderly house slave, the sum of practiced gestures. He was fastidious about his fine black suit and stovepipe hat, extracting lint from the fabric and glaring at it as if it were a poison spider before flicking it away. Homer rarely spoke apart from his hectoring of the horses. Of racial affinity or sympathy, he gave no indication. Cora might as well have been invisible most of the time. Smaller than lint. Homer's duties encompassed driving the team, sundry maintenance, and what Ridgway termed bookkeeping. Homer maintained the business accounts and recorded Ridgway's stories in a small notebook he kept in his coat pocket. What made this or that utterance from the slave catcher worthy of inclusion, Cora could not discern. The boy preserved worldly truism and matter-of-fact observations about the weather with equal zeal. Prompted by Cora one night, Ridgway maintained that he'd never owned a slave in his life, save for the 14 hours Homer was his property. Why not? Cora asked. "What for?" he said. Ridgway was riding through the outskirts of Atlanta. He'd just delivered a husband and wife to their owner, all the way from New York, when he came upon a butcher trying to square a gambling debt. His wife's family had given them the boy's mother as a wedding gift. The butcher had sold her during his previous stretch of bad luck. Now it was the boy's turn. He painted a crude sign to hang around the boy's neck, advertising the offer. The boy's strange sensibility moved Ridgway. Homer's shining eyes, set in his round, pudgy face, were at once feral and serene, a kindred spirit. Ridgway bought him for $5 and drew up emancipation papers the next day. Homer remained at his side despite Ridgway's half-hearted attempts to shoo him away. The butcher had held no strong opinions on the subject of colored education and had permitted the boy to study with the children of some freemen. Out of boredom, Ridgway helped him with his letters. Homer pretended he was of Italian extraction when it suited him and let his questioners sit with their bewilderment. His unconventional attire evolved over time. His disposition remained unchanged. "If he's free," Cora asked, "why don't he go?" "Where?" Ridgway asked. "He's seen enough to know that a black boy has no future, free papers or no. Not in this country. Some character would snatch him and put him on the block lickety-split. With me, he can learn about the world. Find purpose."
Colson Whitehead is author of The Underground Railroad. He's also appearing at the Free Library of Philadelphia tonight at 7:30. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment here on Radio Times. 888-477-9499 is the number to call if you'd like to get in on the conversation. Our email is radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Colson Whitehead is the author of The Underground Railroad. He is also a Pulitzer Prize finalist and a recipient of the MacArthur and Guggenheim Fellowships, and he is here with us for the remainder of the hour talking about his latest novel. Going into the break, Colson, you read a passage from your book regarding a young African-American boy named Homer. And I was curious about the relationship between Homer and Ridgway, the slave catcher who owns him for, what, less than a day before he frees him. And then they stick together. And Homer just seems to completely cross over to Ridgway's side. You know, they're capturing African-Americans. They're on the trail of folks. But it doesn't matter. Homer is with Ridgway. Was that relationship unusual at all for the time?
Well, I think
that sort of relationship?
You know, the master-slave relationship is unusual, and
but for the time, not necessarily.
Well,
I variations.
Mean, there's no model. It seemed plausible, yeah. And yeah, I think it works in the book. You know, there were slaves who were freed and stayed on their plantations after they were freed to work for their master, for former master, for free because they knew nothing else. And what is that? You know, what drives that psychology? And then there were sadistic slave masters who tortured, abused their property, you know, for decades, and still saw themselves as benevolent protectors, helping these childlike Africans by giving them food and clothing in that sort of Bill O'Reilly sense. You know, the slaves who built the White House had it pretty easy because they got free food and free housing. And so you put a lot of work into justifying the perversion of the world that is slavery, and it makes for a strange psychology. So Homer and Ridgway are, you know, one representative of how the system makes strange father-son duos, brothers. You know, it's unclear what they are really.
Yeah. Well, as difficult as this book is to read at times, there is a sense of optimism regarding Cora toward the end of the story, and I won't spill anything here, but why did you decide to take the story there?
Well, you have to, I mean, in order to run away from the plantation, you have to have some optimism, some idea of hope that there's a place where you can be free, even if you, you know, have never left a plantation, I have no idea what being free is. And of course, Cora, as she goes from state to state, has a shifting idea of what it would actually mean to be totally free of the plantation. And you know, my last novel was about the apocalypse and survivors coming together. And
I think Zone One.
Yeah. And they're both animated by the same, you know, human hope that there is a place of refuge beyond the next ridge where the last human survivors, there's a community of people who will take you in and protect you from the world. And so there's that kind of overlap there. And so a slave without hope stays on a plantation. And so that's, you know, I think essential to anyone who, the story of anyone who escapes, and definitely for Cora.
Yeah. So Oprah Winfrey chose this as a selection for her book club. What is the immediate effect of an Oprah book club choice on an author?
It sells a bunch. the premises of my book, you know, can sound oddball sometimes, like intrigue in the Department of Elevator Inspectors and
zombies in New York.
Zombies in New York.
Why did you choose New York, by the way? Is it because that's where you live? Just
well, you know, I'm
your
always
imagination
trying to,
went there.
Well, it's like a, you know, it's a utopian New York. I'm from there, and then after the apocalypse, everyone's dead, and you have to wait in line at Whole Foods. There's no one stealing a cab from you, and so I wanted to present my hopeful vision of New York. But you know, Oprah's endorsement allows people who would, you know, sort of walk by my book in the stores to pause and maybe pick it up. And you know, when the book club started 18 years ago is when I started publishing, and the first thing people would ask you back then, if you met at the hotel bar or on a plane, was like, "You're a writer?" It's like, "Yeah." "Has Oprah picked your book?" And it's like, "No, damn you." And then, you know, the book club sort of, you know, went on hiatus. And so it was very surprising and, you know, a really nice way to send my book off into the world.
So Colson Whitehead, do you come from a literary family? Were you surrounded by books as a kid growing up?
A lot of commercial fiction. You know, the first big book I read in fifth grade was Stephen King's Night Shift, a collection of short stories. And so...
And did it strike you then that this is something you might want to do, write stories of your own?
Or it was 2 years later, reading Carrie in seventh grade, that I thought, oh, I can, you know.
Really?
I think until I got to college, I wanted to write like the Black Salem's Lot or the Black Shining.
Yeah.
Any Stephen King title, you put the black in front of it, is what I wanted to do. And even my sisters, who are 4 years and 8 years older, would read Norman Mailer and Tom Wolfe in his less reactionary 70s new journalism phase. And so I would grow up reading these great nonfiction writers and commercial fiction that my parents read. And it helped. I didn't like to go outdoors. And so I did want to become a writer from an early age.
Yeah. Well, back to a more serious thread here. It's been over 150 years since the Emancipation Proclamation. And over the last few years, of course, there's been a lot of unrest, particularly stemming from the killings of black men by police. Stop and frisk, of course, once again in the political discourse. Why do you think we're still in this place in this country?
Well, we don't do anything, you know, about police brutality. I mean, I think, Ridgway starts as a slave patroller. Slave patrollers 200 years ago were the police force in the South. They could go into any plantation, any free black's house, and demand to see their papers, rough them up, direct echo of, you know, the way sort of corrupt law enforcement works today. And we don't fix it. We talk about it. So people have said, you know, has Ferguson inspired the book?
I was wondering if this book came at a particular time.
In my point of view, Ferguson is a blip. You know, we talk about these things every couple of years when there's a big event, and then we go on to something else. Growing up in New York in the 80s, where you had people like Michael Griffiths being killed in a chokehold by cops, Eleanor Bumpers, a mentally disturbed woman, killed by emergency responders. The stuff that Black Lives Matter is talking about isn't news to me or really, you know, any sort of, you know, I think black American. So if the book came out 5 years from now, you wouldn't have that you wouldn't be thinking about Ferguson because our American amnesia would have kicked in again.
Yeah. So, well, you're of African descent and you know, and a person who happens to be nominated for a Pulitzer for your novel was A John Henry Days. So in your everyday life, are you experiencing, the effects of this country's slave history? Long shadow?
Well, the nightly news should come with trigger warnings now that Trump is, running. I mean, he's just did a whole hour on the thing. So, I was talking before about going too far and, there's a lynching scene in the book and, I definitely have the sort of villain, evil character say a lot of racist things. And, when the New York Times had a reel of some of the rhetoric at Trump campaigns, it drove home once again for the millionth time that, no, I wasn't exaggerating this innate hatred in human beings. And whether it's directed at African-Americans or Mexicans or Muslims or women, demonizing the other is it's not just an American practice. It's a very human practice. Mm. So,
well, so as we just mentioned, slavery probably casts a very long shadow in this country. And yet the civil rights icon, Congressman John Lewis, was in Philly not too long ago. He received the Liberty Medal, I think it was just last week. And in his acceptance speech, he said, "There are some people that have said nothing has changed. Come walk in my shoes and I will show you change." And of course, Lewis helped to lead the 1965 march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. What is he referring to, do you think? Can we take a sense of hope from his words?
No, sure. And I do. And, we do make progress, and it's just very slow progress. I mean, I think we're very sort of dim-witted sort of people, and it takes
in general,
a while.
The American
it takes a while for things to sink
in.
That's
just a human, the human existence.
Yeah, but I think back to people who actually do think that the Underground Railroad was a real thing, and there are people out there, and I'm telling you that it was not a literal set of tracks underground, and I think that's a failure of some teacher along the way and the educational system. And growing up, I definitely would learn about slavery, the first top of the hour, and then Lincoln. And that was like my 1 hour on slavery in fourth grade. And then you hear about separate but equal, and then Martin Luther King. And that's your second hour on race in America in sixth grade.
Well, is that changing for your daughter? Yeah. I mean, about fifth grade now?
Sure. I think they're catching up. And, we are making progress. And but Lincoln doesn't end racism, and Martin Luther King marching on Washington, and our first African American president doesn't usher us into a post-racial future, but it is progress, and I think that's what that quote from John Lewis you brought up is addressing.
Yeah, well, that and on to Barack Obama. I don't know what your political affiliation is, but regardless, in your opinion, what was the perceived promise in Mr. Obama's election to the White House, and has that promise been fulfilled?
I think we're going to miss him immensely. So sort of my takeaway from the last couple of years, the last couple of months watching the campaign. There was a sort of impossible promise heaped upon him. You can't undo 300 years of racial unrest with one swearing-in ceremony. But I think, what he has achieved will ripple out, for decades. And definitely, for my daughter, it's not weird that there's a black president. And who knows, a few months from now, it might not be weird that we have a female president.
Yeah. So Colson Whitehead, again, you've won a number of awards, including the MacArthur Genius Award, and also, again, have been nominated for a Pulitzer for fiction. So when you're told about this, what is your reaction?
It's great. And then when the dust clears, I have to go back to work again, and just me and my computer. So, sometimes your book is well-received in the way you want it to be, and sometimes people don't get it. Either way, you start over with a blank page.
So you start over with a blank page, and again, the writing process involves. You said you were downstairs in the house, and you're
in my little my little hut downstairs.
Are you a morning person, or are you somebody who gets cranking in the evening? Or
I used to do double shifts when I was younger. Now I'm definitely by 8 o'clock. I cook dinner and out by 10:30, watching cooking shows with the family. I think 10 to 3 is a good work day. Sometimes it can be Monday and Tuesday or Saturday and Sunday, but if I can get 4 days of work, and 8 pages a week, it adds up to a novel. It's sort of dorky, but if you write a page a day, that's 365 pages a year. And that's,
everybody's process is different.
Yes, and if you write half a page a day, that's in 2 years you have 365 pages. So, slow and steady wins a race, I think, with novels.
So what's next?
A book that takes place in 1960s Harlem. We'll see if this idea sticks. I mean, I'll be promoting for a while, and I'll definitely have to recharge. But come spring, New York again. I can never seem to write about contemporary New York. But post-apocalyptic New York, 60s New York, and the New York of The Intuitionist, which takes place in a sort of Gotham noirish city, seems to be okay. And maybe I'm gathering strength to write about my hometown.
Hmm. Well, you were quoted in a New York Times article as saying, why not write the book that really scares you? And I obviously it's referring to the Underground Railroad. So in what way
did that
scare you?
At the top of the hour, I talked about having the idea 16 years ago, and I wasn't ready then. I didn't think on a craft level I was ready to pull it off. I need a few more books, to learn a few things and figure some stuff out. And then as a person, I was 30 and, callow, Gen X, weirdo, hanging out all hours.
And, oh, you're not all that bad, I'm sure.
And, having a family and kids and...
Kids change things, don't they?
Well, I think I have my 8-year-old memory of seeing Roots with my family and then reading about slavery in college. And then coming to it, the material, in a deep way, in my mid-40s, I know what I understand more what it is to see like your mother sold off, your kid whipped, your family ripped from you, you never see him again. And in a way that in that first acquaintance in Roots, that sort of really sort of epic moment that a lot of African-American kids had, it's very different, with the perspective of time.
So at the end of the day, what would you like the reader to take away from the Underground Railroad?
Well, I mean, primarily, I'm trying to figure out something about the world and myself in these books, and I'm trying to do it in a way that other people can come along. So if you didn't waste your time, and maybe by talking about the Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment, if you haven't talked about it for a while, talking about North Carolina in a way that echoes... Nazi Germany, or expands our notion of what it is to be oppressed and be an oppressor, I'd be pretty happy.
Colson Whitehead, thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.
Thank you.
Again, the book is The Underground Railroad, and Colson Whitehead will be appearing at the Free Library of Philadelphia this evening at 7:30. And as always, we invite you to check out our Facebook page and take a listen to our podcast. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, Elizabeth Fiedler, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for joining us today for Radio Times.